Could Hawaii's clean energy goals become the nation's? That's the ambitious intention of H.R. 3671, the Off Fossil Fuels for a Better Future Act that Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard has introduced in Congress. Among its more ambitious provisions, a requirement that 80% of new vehicle sales be zero emission by 2027, and that no federal permits for new major fossil fuel projects be issued after the 1st of January. Representative Gabbard is on the phone with us to talk about the measure and its chances in today's political climate. Good morning, Representative Gabbard.
Aloha, Chris. Wonderful to talk to you.
Well, thanks for taking the time. I suppose the first question would be, as I said, it's a pretty polarized political climate and an issue that might in a different age be nonpartisan tends to fall along partisan lines. Does it seem that way to you?
Well, Chris, it is unfortunate that the idea of protecting our environment and preserving our natural resources is a partisan issue. And it's unfortunate that really no serious action has been taken in this regard nationally to this point, which is really what led to the introduction of this bill. Taking inspiration from the legislation and the great and aggressive goals that were passed in Hawaii, we felt strongly that this needed to be done at the national level. Is it going to be easy? No, absolutely not. Unfortunately, this issue has become polarizing, but this gives us the opportunity to be able to engage members of Congress, to be able to talk with and engage with people all across the country in actually moving forward, in pushing this issue, and in really holding leaders accountable for the effects of climate change that we're already seeing today, and why it's important to take action now for generations to come.
Well, in the language of the measure, you refer a number of occasions to scientific findings that, climate change is affirmed by, the great majority of scientific experts. And yet, somehow science itself has become politicized. What do you think made that happen?
Again, unfortunately, when these issues are used as political footballs and kind of turned into these partisan games, the heart of the issue is lost. And so you can talk about the science and the data and the facts that have been proven, but what I have found really makes a difference and resonates with people is when you just break it down to something that's common to everyone, no matter what part of the country you live in. Families in the South, the North, the East, or the West are concerned about making sure their kids have a good future, a good and safe, secure community to live in, a good education. And so when we connect these issues about how our environment and climate change directly impact that common desire that people have, then I think we're able to talk at a more personal level, and it takes it kind of out of the what may be out of reach for some in the scientific realm and just say, hey, this is actually about real life and the things that are basic to all of our lives' existence here on this planet.
There are a number of references in the bill to communities that are affected in one way or another by proximity to fossil fuels, by pollution, and in some ways what you're discussing it as a health issue.
It is a health issue, and we had a press conference on this bill a few weeks ago, and Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who represents Oakland in California, but who grew up in Texas in El Paso, talked about her own personal story and her family who grew up in proximity to a fossil fuels plant and the devastating impact to her own family's health just in the place that they grew up. And unfortunately, we see in many parts of the country that the fossil fuel industry have bases and are in places that are often disproportionately negatively affecting people of color, indigenous communities, and underserved struggling communities. So that impact is something that is in addition to the environmental impact.
By making it a public health issue, you would you would certainly think that public health would cross partisan lines, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is breaking it down to what is the very real impact, both on people's lives today, their families, the impact that has been growing over decades, as well as the longer term impact if we continue to travel down this road where we're so addicted and so dependent on fossil fuels, rather than really recognizing, hey, there's a great opportunity for us as a country, both environmentally as well as economically, to leverage technology and transition off of fossil fuels and towards clean and renewable energy sources.
I'm just wondering how you meet the communications challenge that is involved in all this. You know, it's almost a tectonic shift in the direction the country is taking. How do you bring about something like that? As you said, it's an addiction.
It is a tectonic shift, and it's one that needs to take place. You know, our country has gone through very big, different industrial changes and shifts in the past, and I think this is one of those moments. We have over 400 different environmental groups and different social justice groups and others who have mobilized behind this bill from all across the country because they get it and they get why it's important. So this is how these big changes can occur, is when people at the grassroots, people in communities, start sharing stories with their neighbors, talking story about this bill and why it's important and why we start making these changes, yes, nationally, as well as locally, as we've seen and actually done in Hawaii. So it's easy for some to say, hey, well, this change is just too big to make, or it's not possible. But we're seeing, again, Hawaii's a wonderful example of how maybe 10 or 20 years ago people would have thought it impossible for Hawaii to make as much progress as we have and as quick as we have. So it's a great example to point to as we're having these discussions, saying, look, it's already happening in certain communities like ours in Hawaii. We need to make it happen all across the country.
There are a number of areas in which Hawaii can almost serve as a test lab because it's kind of just the right size to make change and allow it to be studied within the course of a lifetime, yeah?
Yes, no question. And it's a great opportunity to be able to talk about Hawaii with other members of Congress, with different constituencies from other places, and point, have them look to Hawaii, have them come and visit Hawaii, have them learn more about the things that we've been able to do right, you know, the lessons that we've learned along the way, and how places like Kauai, for example. I love using Kauai as an example because their KIUC, their energy co-op, has really taken the bull by the horns, mm-hmm. and have already far exceeded both the statewide goals, but the goals that they set for themselves on the county of Kauai.
Well, it would seem that this bill rises and falls on a communications effort then. You have to really get the word out nationwide and to your fellow legislators, yeah?
That's right. And it, like any other piece of legislation, it really does come down to being able to share and talk about why this legislation is important for everyone, not just for one section of the country versus another, but why it's important for everyone to recognize that preserving and protecting our environment is really a matter of humanity and taking care of our planet, not about red states or blue states or Democrats or Republicans. And that's where I have hope in our efforts, because this is something that we can and should all agree on.
Representative, let me shift gears real quick. We've got a couple of minutes left. I know you're coming home for Veterans Day, and I wanted to ask you, as a veteran, what's your wish list for America's veterans?
The list itself is long, Chris.
I imagine, yeah.
Unfortunately, there's still so much work that needs to be done to make sure that our nation is repaying its debt to our service members and veterans by providing them with the good quality care and benefits that they've earned through their service. You know, I saw and experienced firsthand the cost of war through my two deployments to the Middle East, and you know, my wish, if you ask what my wish is that leaders in Congress would take seriously the cost of war and not continue the same devastating track record of interventionist regime change wars that our country has had for far too long that have cost our country deeply in lives, both American lives and the lives of people in these countries, as well as cost us tremendously financially. And that's where, when you look at the trillions of dollars that we've spent on these interventionist wars just since 9/11 alone, and you think about what we could do with those resources, what we could do with those trillions of dollars, just looking at our basic infrastructure needs in Hawaii, for example, there is so much that could be done. Looking at our needs in education, looking at our needs in healthcare, looking at our needs in further advancing renewable energy and clean energy. So this is my wish and my hope and what I'm working towards here in Congress.
That's yet another one of those tectonic shifts we were talking about, Representative. I wish you luck.
It is, and it's long overdue.
Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Aloha, Chris. Great to talk with you.
Bye-bye. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard represents Hawaii's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Kauai, Maui, and Hawaii counties, as well as Windward, Leeward, and North Shore portions of Oahu. You can find a link to the Off Fossil Fuels for a Better Future Act on today's edition of the Conversation Podcast. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, moving farther and farther away from consensus. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about one of the nastiest invasive species yet, one that's creating a mess in freshwater areas on Kauai. It's an aquatic fern from South America that was probably brought here as a decorative indoor plant. Once it got out, it proceeded to create havoc. It doesn't take much to get a serious infestation started. A tiny seed or a strand of fiber can spread rapidly, forming a thick mat on the surface of water. As Justin Goggins, biologist with the DLNR's Division of Aquatic Resources, says, it starves the river of sunlight and oxygen, but also when it decomposes, it falls to the bottom and changes the system, turns into more marshy. Getting rid of the weed is a messy and labor-intensive process. It has the full intention of the DLNR and the Kauai Invasive Species Council, and we talked about it on the show just last week. Those should be all the hints you need, and so we don't make it too easy. We're looking for its full scientific name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA Hawaii's 2017 Summit, Still Houseless in Hawaii, examining ways to address Hawaii's housing shortage, November 14th at Pomaika'i Ballroom, biahawaii.org.
You can't think about a bill like the clean energy bill we just discussed with Representative Gabbard, a bill that could well have been a bipartisan measure in an earlier era, without thinking about today's polarized political climate. Contributing editor Neil Milner has been thinking about it too, and he has the poll numbers to back him up. as a new study affirms division exists not only between right and left, Democrat and Republican, but within ideological units that once could find common ground. Neil's with us in our studio. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Chris.
It's good to find at least two people who agree with each other on something.
And I'm not so sure about you. Well, right? We don't have enough time to find out.
At least for the moment.
Yeah, right. We'll pretend we agree.
Yeah. Tell me about this study.
Well, this is an interesting study. The Pew Foundation, for the past 30 years, their survey unit, have been doing a series of studies where instead of their political studies, but instead of just identifying whether a person is a Democrat or a Republican or an independent and then spinning off from there, mm-hmm. they ask a series of questions, which you can actually test yourself by asking them, and they see how the country divides up that way and how that compares to being Democrat or Republican. So they're basically right now, according to the most recent survey, there are about 9 different categories. Most of them lean toward conservative or liberal and lean toward one party or another, but mm-hmm. they allow you to see differences within conservatives and within liberals, and it allows you to talk about, which we can do here, whether those differences make any difference.
Yeah. Well, those differences are getting clearly more pronounced.
Well, it's very interesting. The two most important ones that lean conservative are the core conservatives. Those are your kind of standard, older, white conservatives who are pretty well off, and what's called, what they identify as country first conservatives, who are a little bit more like the people that you heard a lot about switching over to Trump. Mm-hmm. And there are some important differences between those two groups, one of which is on immigration, another is on how fair the economic system is. Mm-hmm. And so there are some significant differences along that. The core conservative is much more likely to be politically engaged and all that sort of stuff. Then among the people who lean liberal or Democrats, there's about 3 different groups. There are some important differences there on the fairness of the economy, certainly on the level of education. The strong liberal, which is the kind of heart of the Democratic category in which it turns out I fall, mm-hmm. Tends to be highly educated, pretty affluent, and that sort of thing. So you have these basic differences, but then you within groups, mm-hmm. but then you have some places where those two groups come together. And the most obvious one is on whether they approve of President Trump. It's the most polarized difference. This is probably not new to your listeners. On approval, the difference between people who lean Democratic and people who lean Republican is the most polarized that we've seen in modern history. And so what happens is that even though the core conservatives and the country first conservatives differ on certain matters, they are uniformly, we're talking in the 80s, approvative of Trump. The Democrats, on the other hand, all these other groups, there are some differences, but they tend to be extraordinarily disapproving of Trump. So the question becomes, this is not a question that the Pew tries to answer in the poll, but you can think about is, are those differences within the groups, especially within the conservative groups, are they really going to make a difference when an election comes, considering that there still is this pretty strong approval of Trump among people who are conservative?
In past national elections, we've seen this pattern, Republicans and Democrats. Democrats bicker internally, have trouble getting on the same page. Republicans bicker internally and have a lot less trouble getting on the same page when it comes time to run for election, win an election.
Yeah, that's right. One of the reasons is that the Republican Party is now much more racially homogeneous. It's very, very heavily white. And the Democratic Party is much more diverse, ethnically and racially diverse, than it was, say, 20 years ago. And that creates certain tensions in regard to public policy. But you're right. But what's happening, we have to be really careful about what's happening now, because it's so much in the moment and you can't predict. Yeah. The ferment in the Republican Party is very strong because of the alt-right people trying mm-hmm. to move in a certain direction. And the ferment in the Democratic Party, which has been getting a lot of tension the last few weeks between the Sanders people and the old Clinton people, has been very strong. But what it comes down to, again, is this question of how much difference does that make in forthcoming elections like 2018. there are two ways it can make a difference, one of which is whom you're going to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
But the other, which is just as important, is will you vote at all? And yesterday's results in the Virginia election at least indicated that the Democrats were able to energize their people and get out the vote, which is something that the Pew poll suggests is a problem, because a number of these Democratic-like groups within the Democratic side are much less energized about the election and see less of a difference as a result than the Republicans do. But the other side of it is that we have to remember that an election is not a place that you have gradations.
Mm-hmm.
It's where you have a choice between basically A and B. And that's what I mean about whether the differences within groups are going to make any difference when it comes down to are you going to vote for a Republican or a Democrat.
Well, Neil, getting to that whole A versus B thing, I've often wondered, you know, in Italy they have, what, a dozen political parties and everybody gets 8%, and if they're going to win office, they have to form a coalition. And I've often wondering how we've managed to hang on to two political parties as long as we have.
Well, there are two reasons, one of which is we have a presidential system, but the other one is basically it's a winner-take-all system. If you have a political system that constitutionally says that the person who gets the plurality or the majority, you know, plus one, mm-hmm. is going to get everything, then it's very hard to get minor parties represented in government. There's other kinds of social and cultural reasons why socialism didn't arise. But, you know, if the only way you're going to get a seat in Congress is, or to become the prime minister or whatever, is if you have to get, you know, you have to get over
51%.
Half the votes,
yeah,
it makes it, that's the most important reason. And that's why these kinds of things, if this were a parliamentary system, these gradations might make a difference within the conservative movement.
Mm-hmm.
You might have some who, you know, some people who get elected within the same state as one kind of conservative versus the other, and the same with liberals. But in this case, in our case, that simply can't happen.
Well, it certainly sounds as if you can no longer, if you ever could, describe being a Democrat or Republican as a kind of a monolithic.
I don't know. That's an interesting question, because it depends on what you're asking about. We're certainly, if you just ask whether a person is a Democrat or a Republican or a liberal and conservative, the country sorts itself out much better or much worse, depending on how you see it, more fully than it did, say, even 20 years ago. If you're a liberal, you're much more likely to be in the Democratic Party than, say, you were 20 years ago, and the same with Republicans, conservatives. There's almost no overlap, conservative Democrats and so on. But that doesn't mean that there certainly are important differences that exist. It just comes down to, in an election, whether those differences make that much difference.
We're going to be seeing a lot of that in the year to come, aren't we, Neil?
Yes, and I wouldn't make any predictions yet. Remember how bad we were in 2016 making predictions.
Well, all is forgiven. We'll be making predictions in the
coming
year. Well,
yes, I suppose, but I'll be doing it with a certain degree of humility that I maybe lacked before.
Yeah, fair enough, Neil. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our segment, The Long View, and you can find a link to that Pew survey on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Back in the days when a day at Ala Moana Center meant shopping at Liberty House or Sears and grabbing a bite at Patty's Chinese Kitchen, the surrounding neighborhood was a mix of inexpensive apartments, hostess bars, and mom-and-pop stores. But just as the center has gone upscale, so has the neighborhood, and local people who moved to the Ala Moana neighborhood back in the day are feeling squeezed out by expensive high-rises. Anita Hofschneider has the story in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Anita.
Aloha.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You kind of walked the neighborhood and talked to people about the changes they see going on around them, didn't you?
Yes, I went with our photographer, Corey, and we walked around to some of the business areas where some of these new developments are planned. And we talked to people working in stores and who are walking along the street to see whether they knew about the plans and what they thought about them.
What kind of answers did you get?
Most people either had no idea about these plans or they weren't very happy about them. I mean, there were a couple of people working in businesses who hoped that the new developments would revitalize the area. But for the most part, people we were talking to had a lot of anxiety about them.
Trouble with revitalizing an area is your rent goes up, right?
That's the fear. I mean, I talked to one woman in particular who rents an apartment for less than $1,000, and she is on the cusp of retiring, and so she'll probably have a fixed income. And she's not, she's just not sure what's going to happen. She's worried that her landlord is going to see all the high rises going up nearby and going to decide that to either raise the rent or to sell the building, and that she'll be priced out.
Has anybody figured out what the impact is going to be when all these high-rises go up and get occupied and those cars hit the street?
Everybody I was talking to was saying that, we won't really know the impact until we actually see it. But Kaka'ako, right next door, where some of these high-rises are going up, has shows a little bit about what can happen when a neighborhood changes. And there's a lot of positive things that people enjoy with new businesses and more walkable streets and bike paths. But there are, residents there have also complained about traffic getting worse and parking getting harder to find. So it's definitely a mixed bag.
Well, it's a classic gentrification story. And, it isn't that long ago that Kaka'ako was little more than tin roof shacks, auto repair joints and places you could get, get your tires changed, that kind of thing. It's coming fast to this area because a lot of those buildings are going to go online within the next couple of years, yeah?
Well, I hesitate to say that they will because you never know with financing. There's a lot of different factors at play, but a couple of them are definitely slated to begin construction next year. A couple of new developments have already been completed. There's just a lot happening, a lot of plans in the works, and if they all come into fruition, then Ala Moana's skyline will look a lot different than it does today.
That's very likely, Anita. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Anita Hofschneider.
Water is one of those things that you open the faucet and it comes out. You don't think about how much it costs until it costs a lot.
There's a wide disparity of what Chicagoans and Chicago suburbanites pay for their water.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Chicago, and it's H2O. That is next time on Market Play.
This evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
There's nothing like talk of a massive tax overhaul to cause elation in some sectors, despair in others, and confusion more or less across the board. Despite promises that tax cuts would benefit the middle class, many independent sources seem to be saying rather the opposite. The rich would benefit, people on society's bottom rung would suffer. We'd want to find out how accurate that is, and we're hoping Tom Yamachika, president of this Tax Foundation of Hawaii, can help us make sense of it all. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Chris.
What is it that the administration and the Republican tax plan want to accomplish? What's the, how do you sum up what that tax plan would be?
Well, what they're trying to do is basically overhaul the tax code, make it, I think a lot of it is directed at the business side to make it more internationally competitive, because right now we have some features in our tax code that make it uncompetitive internationally, whereas in most countries, most of the OECD countries, the ones that are developed, they basically have, with a business that's operating in more than one country, mm-hmm. they let the country that the business is operating in tax the business, and then the home country, if you will, of that multinational group, you know, doesn't step in and add more. Mm-hmm. Ours does. When the multinational has a headquarters in the United States, the U.S. federal tax kind of layers on top of the taxes that are paid by the you know, the businesses in the other countries, and adds an additional burden to them.
So if you want to operate offshore, you'll never be entirely free of U.S. taxes under the current tax code. Yeah,
that's correct.
So how do you get around that? I mean, just simply abolishing that provision?
That's what they're planning to do. They're trying to basically scrap it and go to what they call a territorial tax system, which is similar to what the other OECD countries have.
Argument being what? That the current U.S. system is a disincentive to business?
That's correct.
Businesses respond to that how? By just simply uprooting and getting out of the country?
A lot of them do that. It's called businesses expatriating. You've heard about that concept in the news every so often. Mm-hmm. That's what they've been doing. They pull out, they reincorporate in some place more tax friendly, like Bermuda or the Channel Islands or places like that.
So, having abolished that provision, how do you create an incentive for them to come back?
Well,
the businesses that have already relocated.
Well, that's kind of when the normal economic types of competition comes in. I mean, you can have the U.S. Make the pitch that they have a better, smarter, more talented workforce, or they have a better, more developed legal system, or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But off the tax arena.
The question that's going to be uppermost in everybody's mind when they talk about a tax overhaul is what happens to me.
Of course.
Right, based on their income. And so, a person at a moderate income, and I'm not even sure how a moderate income would be defined in Hawaii, but what's likely, let's pick a figure for a moderate income in Hawaii and figure out what would the possible impact be.
Well, I've seen some analyses done, not by us, but the Tax Foundation in Washington, saying that there would be, a modest but broad-based, relief, a lessening of the federal tax burden kind of across the board. And, I've seen, a number of, politically energized commentators say, well, geez, that means we're, giving a massive tax cut to the rich.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but the reality is that and at least according to the Office of Management and Budget, which is a federal nonpartisan agency, the top quintile of income earners in the U.S. pay 95% of their taxes, 95%. So if you're going to do any kind of tax cut, it's got to trickle up.
So almost every kind of tax cut you would enact it benefits the rich. It sounds as if you could hardly do a tax cut without people saying that it's a tax cut that benefits the rich. That's where most of the money is.
That's right. I mean, you look at the lowest quintile. Federal government pays them on average. The next quintile, it's kind of, the numbers are very small.
Mm-hmm.
Middle class, yeah, they start paying in, and then the upper quintile is the one that pays the tax.
So, by making a tax cut across the board, everybody's got a little more money. They go out and spend it, and the rising tide lifts all boats. Is that the philosophy?
Right. I mean, businesses make more. They hire more people. They produce more things. They sell more. The economic engine starts, getting more fuel and revs up, and the economic engine is what produces all revenue in the first place.
Has that that equation been verified by past experience? You know, tax cut benefits middle class spends, everybody wins. Has that, you know, is there are there data to back that up?
Again, depending on who you believe, yes, there is. I think there's a strong sentiment that during the mid 1980s when the Reagan overhaul took place, there was some boost in economic activity. The Tax Foundation in Washington, they say they have an economic model that is able to predict the economic activity with a reasonable amount of accuracy, and they are saying that that'll happen if the currently proposed tax plan is enacted in anything close to its current form.
This is what was referred to in the 80s as trickle down. It really does trickle down.
Yes.
So that's a verifiable benefit of a tax cut. The question that always arises also in a tax cut is, does it leave the nation with enough funds to operate?
Well, again, that's a question of what do you need to operate? If you give more money to government, they'll spend it.
Yeah, that's been shown to be true.
yeah.
No argument there.
Yeah. So the question then becomes, well, what's the right size of government?
Mm-hmm.
I heard Representative Gabbard just talking about how trillions of dollars was spent on defense efforts, and she thinks unwisely. There are, of course, people who don't share that view, but there is certainly going to be a substantial divergence of opinion on, how much money is necessary to run government.
We'll just have to see, I guess. Thanks very much for talking with us, Tom.
Thank you.
Tom Yamachika is the president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii, and you can find links to an additional analysis of the Republican tax plan on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Today's backyard quiz, we reminded you of a conversation we had last week about a persistent and troubling invasive weed on Kauai. It's found in freshwater areas, especially along the banks of the Kilauea River, where it forms a thick mat on the surface of the water. The DLNR has brought its famed super sucker to Kauai to grab as much of the weed as it can, and a task force of about 12 people from the Division of Aquatic Resources, the State Department of Agriculture, and the Kauai Invasive Species Committee is at work on the infestation. It came from South America, and like so many other invasives, it was probably brought here as a decorative plant, only to end up in the ecosystem making a mess. We asked you for its full scientific name, and it's all too fitting. It's Salvinia molesta. And the winner is Sanjay from Pacific Heights. Congratulations, and we'll try to keep you away from invasive weeds. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
HPR's Atherton Studio is the place to find so many of Hawaii's musical stars. On Saturday the 18th, it's vocalist Star Kalahiki with her longtime collaborator, pianist Kit Ebersbach. They'll delight you with lounge standards, show tunes, and Hawaiian classics. Your tickets are at 955-8821 during business hours or hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
The grounding of the 79-foot commercial fishing vessel Pacific Paradise offshore less than a mile off Diamond Head near the Outrigger Canoe Club raises a number of concerns, environmental and legal. How did the vessel get there? Who was in charge? The Coast Guard never got a distress call and had to rescue 19 foreign nationals aboard. We spoke with Robert Richmond, director of the University of Hawaii's Kuala Marine Laboratory, about the grounding.
In any ship grounding, there's basically the two elements of physical damage, which is just what the impact of the fishing vessel hull does to the environment, in this case, a coral reef area right off of Waikiki.
Yeah.
And the second is the water quality, which is tied to any of the chemicals on board. According to the reports I've seen, there was about 8,000 gallons of diesel, 55 gallons of hydraulic fluid and other kinds of lubricants, and then, of course, the batteries and the lead acid from the batteries as well. So there's a chemical and then there's a physical.
How much damage can that do?
A substantial amount. It depends on what happens after the grounding in the immediate area, in addition to any leakage of fuel oil or any other pollutants and toxicants on board the vessel. Fishing boats, like all other boats, have anti-fouling paints on the bottom that can include heavy metals such as copper. They can have chemicals that are toxic to marine life. So you have the immediate area of the physical impact and also any of the anti-fouling paints that are chipped off or scraped along the bottom. And then any leakage of materials such as oil compounds and other toxicants on board the vessel. So it can be anywhere from the immediate area to hundreds of meters surrounding the vessel.
How much is are things like this regulated, you know, the presence of different chemicals on board a vessel like this?
They are. So the Coast Guard is the first responder when there's a ship grounding, and according to all the reports I've read, the Coast Guard did respond. Interestingly, in looking at the material in the news, it was eyewitnesses that reported it to the Coast Guard, not the original vessel captain or the people who operate the vessel. But the Coast Guard responded, and they have a responsibility. There's something called OPA 90, the Oil Pollution Act, which deals with things like ship groundings and oil spills that can occur with them. And then EPA can often be involved in this case. Since Hawaii doesn't have a state EPA, it would likely be the Department of Health and their water quality group.
Why didn't the crew or the captain report it? Is there any way to figure that out?
Not to my knowledge. I just looked at the other news reports from the Associated Press, from the local TV stations, and the Star Advertiser. But according to the reports I read, it was the eyewitnesses that filed the first report with the Coast Guard that initiated their response.
I'm assuming under maritime law, it's the responsibility of the captain to do some notification, yeah?
I'm not a legal expert, but it would seem to me appropriate. And it was interesting, too, that in addition to the captain and the typical crew, which on a fishing vessel would be seven, maybe nine fishers, there were reportedly a total of 20 people on board the vessel, which included, from my reading of the news, individuals that were going to be put onto other fishing vessels that do not have authority to set foot on U.S. soil.
Which kind of leads to the question of how does a vessel get grounded in this particular place in the first place?
That certainly is a huge question to me. I mean, it's not as if people don't know where Waikiki is, that the vessel being that close to shore is a concern, that they should be navigating well outside of these shallow areas. And it's not just for environmental and safety of the reefs and the other areas around it, but for the captain and crew. The fact that it was that close to a shallow area is a surprise to me.
Well, a vessel with too many crew members, more crew members than needed, and a grounding in a pretty unlikely place, something might seem to be falling through the cracks here in terms of maritime regulation, no?
Oh, certainly, and I think, again, I can only go by what I've read, and certainly the responsibilities of the Coast Guard and other law enforcement, Customs and Border Patrol would be the agencies that would address those kinds of issues. But as a marine biologist, first and foremost, I'm very concerned when accidents like this happen that affect the coastal resources of Hawaii and beyond. And as a human being, I'm also concerned about the reports that have been coming out from the Hawaii Longliners fleet about, you know, what's been dubbed human trafficking in the reports. The fact that the fishers on board these vessels have been alleged to be individuals that get very low salaries, live in areas of very poor conditions. And so, you know, the marine biologist in me is worried about the ocean. The human in me is concerned about the way in which people are treated.
Because it would seem that this grounding is perhaps points to a much larger problem, practically ocean-wide, yeah?
Certainly, and, you know, the Hawaii Longliners Association and the Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council, known as WESPAC, have a long history of trying to avoid any kind of regulation on fishing, and my most recent interactions have been on the expansion of the Papanaumokuakea Marine National Monument in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. That, interestingly enough, this effort for the expansion began within the Native Hawaiian community. A number of highly respected Native Hawaiian practitioners, people like Nainoa Thompson, William Isla, Kamana Apono Crab, the CEO of Office of Hawaiian Affairs, approached the Obama administration about expanding protections in the Papanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. As a marine scientist, I actually was brought in after the initial efforts by the Native Hawaiian community to provide science in support of it. And what we found ourselves was constantly in confrontations with the Hawaii Longliners Association, with WESPAC, about additional protections, which they fought tooth and nail. They're now fighting to try to open up the Pacific remote islands and other areas to fishing, when in fact sustainability tells us that this is the wrong direction to go and actually works against the interests of the fishing community themselves.
Momentum would seem to be on that side.
Well, there's a huge concern. A lot of us have been very concerned. We thought that the movement forward under the Obama administration for the expansion of Papanaumokuakea and previously three of the five islands in the Pacific remote islands were very sound decisions based on good cultural considerations, sound science, and the whole hope for sustainability in an ocean where most scientists would agree we need to set aside about 30% of the ocean into protection if there will be a legacy of fish for future generations. We're now at about 3%. And so these continued efforts by WESPAC and groups like the Hawaii Longliners Association to undercut the protections that are so sound is certainly disturbing to me.
Robert Richmond is the director of the University of Hawaii's Kualo Marine Laboratory, where he conducts research on marine conservation and coral reefs.
The Panama Papers exposed how dictators hide their wealth. Now, a new leak called the Paradise Papers shows who's profiting from island tax shelters.
Everything from Apple to Facebook, Walmart, Uber. What we are seeing is really industrial scale tax avoidance.
This week, Reveal joins the global hunt for answers.
This evening at 7.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, we can learn about the challenges faced by artists in Asia in a symposium at UH Manoa. Yeah?
Yes, it's happening Thursday. This symposium will look at traditional materials, the methods and styles of art making among the artists of Asia. Three scholars of Asian art will speak, followed by a moderated discussion. And this symposium is tomorrow from 3 to 5 p.m. in UH Manoa's Art Building, Room 101.
And back in the day, Portuguese sweetbread was baked in stone ovens in Hawaii.
Yes, and you can learn how this was done tomorrow in Kona Licona Historical Society has a reproduction of a typical stone oven used by Portuguese immigrants who came to Kona back in the 1880s. I'll learn how to pan the dough and bake loaves of sweet bread between 10 a.m. to 12:30 tomorrow. The program is free, but the bread is $8 per loaf, and the Kona Historical Society is in Kealakekua.
And fresh baked bread is so much better.
Oh, yes. No
comparison, right?
No. Yeah.
And if you're a newcomer to Honolulu, you can join this group.
Right, and this group is called Newcomers of Honolulu. Yeah, believe it or not. Very fitting name. You can meet them at their monthly Aloha Coffee Time, Thursday from 10 to 11:30 a.m. Their goal is to introduce members to others with similar interests through social activities and to also learn about the islands. And to find out where the meeting is, you just go to our website.
And that's where you'll find out.
Right? Mm-hmm. And more.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Lou Reed with music critic Anthony DeCurtis, author of a new biography of Reed. DeCurtis was also Reed's friend and interviewed many people Reed knew, including two of his former wives. We'll talk about how Reed's transgressive music related to his life. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, right after On Point.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll look at a biography of an eyewitness to a time of revolutionary change in Hawaii. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandergood. Join us tomorrow.